But I have a deeper and broader concern about their analysis. What I'm seeing now is that the problem we identified in last week's show, that because of power's invisibility, the clandestine manner of the global state statesmen's mechanisms for organizing the world and of their own planning, when our three present their analysis of how the world system operates, because power remains hidden and out of that picture, it gives this false sense of legitimacy, a false veneer of inevitability that has set us back. Or perhaps we should say that we've been stuck in it and have not been able to progress, advance our resistance. I'm beginning to see that the implications of this problem run deep and must be plumbed and most deft discussed using the frame of our Earth allegiance and of our developing people's language of refusal, or rather, a language that looks beyond the system, a language of turning towards each other and towards the world we want, and with a fearless acceptance of the results of the analysis that our reason gives us. Continuing, the asymmetry was most dramatically exemplified on the battlefields themselves. Following the precedent of the Chinese War of National Liberation, the Vietnamese showed how a national liberation movement could, by shifting the confrontation with conventional armies onto non-conventional terrains, as in guerrilla warfare, erode and eventually disintegrate the social, political, and military position of cumbersome imperial forces. From this point of view, the other movements, particularly the U.S. anti-war movement, were part and parcel of this asymmetrical relation. To different degrees and in different ways, they showed how the shift of the confrontation between systemic and anti-systemic forces onto non-conventional terrain was strengthening the latter and hampering, paralyzing the former. My interjection, what if they're wrong? What if, as we saw during our readings of Savage Continent, that all the bloodletting was exactly what power wanted? The view of all changes when we admit that the goal of power has ever been to keep the cattle herded. What if the result is the intention? All the waste of our lives in war, all the bloodletting. Truman's words were not an aberration. Let them kill as many of each other as possible. That statement we learned from the Kevin Phillips book, American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. And I don't mean by this that they waste our lives in war with intent, that war is driven by a lust for profits, by a system of acquisition gone mad, ignoring its destructiveness. I'm not referring to a greedy arms industry, as Chalmers Johnson is describing in this quote. In many cases, the United States has been busy arming opponents in ongoing conflicts, Iran and Iraq, Greece and Turkey, Saudi Arabia and Israel, China and Taiwan. Saddam Hussein, the number one rogue leader of the 1990s, was during the 1980s. Simply an outstanding customer with an almost limitless line of credit because of his country's oil reserves. Often the purchasing country makes its purchases conditional on the transfer of technology so that it can ultimately manufacture the item for itself and others. The result is the proliferation around the world, not just of weapons, but of new weapons industries, unquote, from Chalmers Johnson, Blowback, quoted in Kevin Phillips' American Dynasty, let them kill as much of each other as possible. So I'm not suggesting arms industry gone rampant, but rather a broader misanthropy the extent of which shocked Kevin Phillips when he probed it. Quote, moral rhetoric notwithstanding, petroleum needs and armaments buildups have been important factors and motivators in two world wars. Not incidentally, they have also been pillars of Bush family advancement. Oil, in particular, has long been a linchpin for defense and national security elites. After eight decades of Bush family private experience, even the born-again George W. Bush of the late 1980s was happy to take investment dollars from oil sheiks. Important, and this is continuing with Kevin Phillips, important as oil has been, great power geopolitics has had a glamour and historical momentum beyond economics. Intellectuals in U.S. defense agencies, for their part, especially those denied their own military surfeit as youths, my interjection, he's saying here that they are perpetual children. I would say perpetual abandoned children. Continuing. Intellectuals and U.S. defense agencies, for their part, especially those denied their own military surfeit as youths, became caught up in what pundits called a latter-day version of the great game played out a century ago in South Central Asia. Indeed, imperial motivation have led to an outsized share of military conflicts. None of the Bushes has ever been a serious intellectual in defense or foreign policy matters. For them, physical activity, especially sports such as golf or speed boating, has been more appealing than long evenings devoted to abstract thought. The effect has been to leave George W. Bush, like previous Texan wartime President Lyndon Johnson, at the mercy of second-rate defense intellectuals, this time ones who had changed the gray pinstripe of neoconservative think tanks for Pentagon togas of neo-imperialism, unquote, from Kevin Phillips' American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. Kevin Phillips explains in his preface why the more he delved into the Bush dynasty, the more he could see its participation with and insinuation into defining a clandestine, deceptively planned, entirely kept hidden imperial mission for the U.S. state. Quote, I'm not talking about ordinary lack of business ethics. I'm quoting Kevin Phillips. I'm not talking about ordinary lack of business ethics or financial corruption. Four generations of building towards dynasty, however, have infused the Bush family's hunger for power and practices of crony capitalism with a moral arrogance and backstage disregard of the democratic and republican traditions of the U.S. government. As we will see, four generations of involvement with clandestine arms deals and European and Middle Eastern rogue banks will do that. Few have looked at the facts of the family's rise. But just as important, commentators have neglected the thread, not the mere occasion, of special interests, biases, scandals, especially those related to arms dealing, and blatant business cronyism. The evidence that accrues over four generations is extremely damning. This is especially true of the Bush's ties to the Wall Street financial world and the military-industrial complex. But considering an additional relationship may explain even more. After four generations of connection to foreign intrigue and the intelligence community, plus three generations of immersion in the culture of secrecy dating back to the Yale years of several men in the family, deceit and disinformation have become Bush political hallmarks. The Middle Eastern financial ties of both Bush presidents exemplify this lack of candor, as do the origins and machinations of both Bush wars with Iraq. It doesn't help that the major media have tended to use kid gloves with the family. Unquote. This is from the preface to Kevin Phillips' American Dynasty. The question we should ask to test the motive I'm imputing to them, to the global state statesmen, this motive of hurting us, is whether, after all the bloodletting, all the violence, were we, the global people, more or less, quote unquote, disciplined? I.e., were our hearts broken? Did the Grinch steal Christmas as we're seeing across the African and Arab and Asian and South American lands? In Sierra Leone, the state has outlawed touching. No more touching babies. Let them cry to no response. That should instill discipline. Have we been left in shock? Were the people more tightly organized in state boxes? And without question, we can answer, oh yeah.